Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.cqut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@cqut.ca.
You're listening to a pre-recorded episode of the Prison Radio Show. My name's Noah, and I'm your host for today's show. Today on the Prison Radio Show, we have another documentary from the Freedom Archive Project. This documentary is about Attica and the origins of the modern anti-prison movement. We'll also be airing audio from the Talk to Me Project. The Talk to Me Project is an interview and story-sharing project between Black people in prison and Black people on the outside. We had Elena and Kai from the Talk to Me Project on our show last year. Today we'll be sharing new audio interviews that they have conducted as part of programming this month for Black History Month. But in doing so, we want to recognize the reality that Black people are disproportionately targeted by every aspect of the prison industrial system in both the United States and Canada, including, but certainly not limited to, racial profiling, police brutality, high rates of incarceration, abuse and discrimination inside prisons, racist treatment in the court systems, and what is often referred to as the school-to-prison pipeline. And this, the importance of talking about this, absolutely must not and cannot be limited to Black History Month. First up, we have a history of Attica and the origins of the modern anti-prison movement. But just before we bring you that documentary from the Freedom Archives, we have some very exciting news. Albert Woodfox, the last remaining member of the Angola 3, still behind bars, has been released. He was released on February 19th, which was also his 69th birthday. Woodfox was in prison for 43 years and 10 months for a crime he did not commit, and most of that time was spent in solitary confinement. Woodfox can now receive the medical care he so desperately needs and plans to spend the majority of his time working against the conditions of solitary confinement. For more information about Albert Woodfox and the Angola 3, you can visit angola3.org.
Speak about revolution, they must speak about a change, because we are human beings and we got to be treated like human beings.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such.
If you put people under these kind of conditions, they're going to rebel, you know, and that's what Attica teaches you.
What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed.
This September marks the 30th anniversary of the historic Attica State Prison Rebellion and Massacre. The story of Attica is one of the most heroic and brutal chapters in U.S. history. After a five-day occupation, 43 people were killed, 150 were shot, and 1,289 tortured. As one of the slogans of that time put it, Attica is all of us. On this 30th anniversary, with more than 2 million people now imprisoned in the United States, the true story of Attica, now more than ever, needs to be told. On this program, you will hear the voices of prisoners, including L.D. Barkley, a prison leader who proclaimed the Attica Manifesto to the world and was killed during the massacre. You'll also hear Frank Big Black Smith, who survived the massacre and describes the torture that took place in its aftermath. You'll also hear other prisoners and guards taken hostage during the five-day occupation, as well as Elizabeth Fink and Michael Deutsch, two attorneys among many who defended prisoners charged with the rebellion, gained acquittals and clemencies, then brought and eventually settled damage suits on behalf of the prisoners. Like all mass rebellions, the Attica Rebellion was preceded by a long chain of abuses, years of petition and protest to improve conditions, years of false promises of reform by the prison administration.
We felt that the people should come together and get a better understanding of the conditions here, what was being did to them by the administration. So behind this, we would hold meetings in the yard. You know, we would hold open house, and whoever wanted to come to listen to our political ideology, they were welcome. We didn't bar anyone. This was frowned on by the institution, and they would break it up. In order to reach everyone, we had to get along with different factions here, the Muslims and the five centers and all the other factions, to become one solid movement. We start talking about a strike. They made a lot of promises about conditions would be better, the food would get better, and, the medical conditions would be better. It was a lot of promises. So everyone laid, they waited, you know, and nothing was did. This is when the Attica Liberation Faction began. We wanted to do things diplomatically. You know, we were seeking reform, although many were not in favor of reform because they didn't believe that the people would listen. So we sought support from the entire population.
People were not interested in waiting for change. They wanted to make change.
Attorney Elizabeth Fink.
The prisoners themselves had gone through a number of different routes to try and change the barbaric conditions that were at Attica. The fact that they were forced to work in the metal shop at 107, 108 degrees for 56 cents a day. The fact that most people were Muslims and the major meat that was given was pork. There was no educational programs. There were no Third World Guards. There was no representation in any kind of parole hearings. There was just nothing. And the situation in the New York State prisons, as in every other prison in every other state, was deeply racist. All the guards were white, and the vast majority of the prisoners were Third World. And up until about 1969, at Attica, for example, everybody stays in their block. They eat with their block, they work with their block, and they wreck with their block. And there's only one day a year where you open up the prison, and that was the 4th of July. And they had this institution called Black Ice and White Ice. They'd bring out this ice, and it was white ice, and only the white people could use it. And then they'd bring out this other ice, and it was black ice. That was only the black people. And this just lasted until, like, 69.
In the months preceding September 9, 1971, prisoners had written a manifesto protesting conditions and listing grievances. There had been no response from the administration. Then, on August 21, 1971, prison movement leader and writer George Jackson was shot down at San Quentin Prison in California. We hear from Attica prisoners about the response to that assassination.
Things were getting worse. What really solidified things was George Jackson's death. This had a reaction on the people that we were trying to accomplish all along to bring them together. We thought of, well, how could we pay tribute to George Jackson, because a lot of us idolized him, the things that he was doing, the things he was exposing about the system. So we decided that we would have a silent fast that whole day in honor of him. We would wear black armbands. No one was to eat anything that whole day. We noted that if the people could come together for this, and they could come together for other things.
I didn't know anything about, you know, George Jackson. What George Jackson? So we were going to chow that morning, and when we got in the mess, so everything was quiet. Nobody seen nothing. And you talking about 500, 600, 700 people, inmates. Nobody was eating. So I asked one of my buddies, Carlos, I said, what's up, man? He said, shh, be cool, guy. I said, I didn't tell you, man. This dude, George Jackson, in California, killing, and man, there's some kind of solidarity. Ain't nobody eating. But then it went away. I didn't eat. We sat down, but it was, woo.
And so they saw the effect of that mass action, joint action, on the administration and the guards, which was total terror. And I believe that it empowered them.
It was a seemingly small repressive incident against a black and white prisoner that triggered the occupation itself. The tensions of the past years and months erupted into a rebellion by prisoners from 4 cell blocks and the occupation of D Yard by over 1,500 prisoners. Black, Puerto Rican, Native American, and white prisoners joined together over 5 days, proclaiming demands, caring for guards held hostage, and naming a number of prominent progressive activists, lawyers, and journalists as intermediaries as negotiations began. L.D. Barkley read their manifesto.
The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971, but of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard of the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We will not compromise on any terms except those terms that are agreeable to us. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to the situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you. We have set forth demands that will bring us closer to the reality of the demise of these prison institutions that serve no useful purpose to the people of America, but to those who enslave and exploit the people of America.
The manifesto's been gone out 3-4 months, and nothing has happened. And as I say, the conditions, they just got worse.
These prisoners in front of the whole world organized a structure where they had elections in the blocks and people who represented them, and a conglomeration of white people and black people and brown people, all of whom were empowered. And everybody got to watch that over the 5 days, and it was really intense.
Our demands are such. We want complete amnesty, meaning freedom from all and any physical, mental, and legal reprisals. We want now speedy and safe transportation out of confinement to a non-imperialistic country. We demand that the federal government intervene so that we will be under direct federal jurisdiction. We want a governor and the judiciary to guarantee that there will be no reprisals. And we want all facets of the media to articulate this. We guarantee the safe passage of all people to and from this institution. We invite other people to come here and witness this degradation so that they can better know how to bring this degradation to an end. This is what we want.
During the occupation, interviews were conducted with prisoners and with guards held hostage.
These people in here are treated like dogs. Not only the black, the Puerto Rican, the black, and the white. Right up. And I want everyone to know that we're going to stick together, we're going to get what we want, or we're going to die here. All of them.
My name is Johnny Delgado. I'm a Puerto Rican, and I'm proud to be a Puerto Rican. And I've always been proud to be a Puerto Rican. Now, I'm going to lay it on you the way it is. These people here, I'm trying to kill us. All these dogs up there with those rifles are trying to kill us. But we ain't going to quit. You know, why are we not going to quit? Because we're one. We're one unit. We're tired of being beaten. We're tired of being oppressed. We're going to get this if we all have to die. All of us.
What is your name, please?
Frank Draw.
What is your job?
Correctional officer.
Now, we
want to know exactly what do you think of the way you're treated in here by these men?
We all have been treated 100%. Been fed well, gave us blankets, slept on mattresses while they slept on the ground. Medication was given to us while they didn't get any. They took care of us first. We've been taken care of at least 100%.
How do you think these men should be treated henceforth?
I think they should be treated 150%. I know they have grievances. I know because I work with them. They've got grievances. I know these grievances. We have to tell those people out there about them.
We all wish we could be home. And by we, I don't mean 38 of us. I mean all of us. All 1,538 of us.
To the oppressed people all over the world, we have the solution. The solution is unity.
I'd like to speak to the brothers in Buffalo. And I want you brothers to get together because we together here. And we, these people think we shucking and jiving, but we is for real. We are as serious as cancer. We are for real.
Noted radical attorney William Kunstler, one of the intermediaries named by the prisoners, was interviewed just outside Attica State Prison on September 13, 1971. His words proved prophetic.
The commissioner told us last night that he was going through his own ordeal and that he had not made up his mind what to do. We implore him now to have no force in there. They want to continue to talk. If they go in there, it's going to be a massacre in this prison, and it's on the heads of the authorities if it takes place. And I have nothing but the greatest of sympathy both for the guards and for the inmates inside. Time can produce something here, but a loss of time and a show of force will produce only death and misery, not only here, but I'm sure we'll have a reaction in black ghettos and other areas throughout the country.
Well, is Governor Rockefeller going to come here? Will he consider doing that? Do you think he should come here?
He should come. His refusal to come here is a monstrosity, because what he is saying is kill these men. I have no concern. All I want to do is restore the law and order, and I think that's a rotten exchange for lives.
Now, one of the observations. One of the observation helicopters is taken off. And with it, now for the first time, one of the large army helicopters is taken off. It is known that the army helicopters are loaded with what is called riot gas, though not quite sure what kind of gas it is. Anyway, here come the helicopters, and they are now heading for the prison. One of the large army helicopters now going overhead, over the wall, into the prison. Any idea what's going on behind this cover of gas?
I think we're about to witness a massacre. We just tried a man for Mili and convicted him. And now Mili number two is taking him place. That is an absolute act of bestiality on the part of this man who calls himself an elected official of this state. I hope that the black people of America and the Puerto Rican people of America remember this day.
The helicopter contained dropped the CS, and at the exact moment that gas was dropped, they started to shoot. Exactly at that moment. And then they cleared the catwalks. They just murdered everybody on the catwalk.
It was a slaughter line, man. It was people were defenseless. All right, they had sticks and homemade weapons to defend themselves, but this doesn't compare, man, with magnums and carbines. But this is ridiculous, you know? The next thing I got was this big helicopter flying over us, and tear gas is coming from everywhere. It's a whole lot of shooting carrying on. So naturally, everyone is running for cover, you know? So I'm next to the wall, and I know around me that everyone is hide the face and dives and spitting rags and putting it to the nose. But what I know was troopers start coming from everywhere, but then I started seeing different people fall. You know? They were shot. Guys was losing their hands, shot in the head, necks.
The power structure led by Nelson Rockefeller.
Attorney Elizabeth Fink
wanted to show to the world, and certainly to the rebellious forces within his own country, with the advice and consent and affirmation of Richard Nixon, what the price is for rebellion. And so they created this assault force, which was there to murder everybody.
There were 4,500 rounds of ammunition fired on a cage of people, and there were 1,289 people in it. They used high-powered rifles with dum-dum bullets that entered and exploded on impact. And they used shotguns with 8 to 12 36 caliber bullets with an indiscriminate 50-yard spread. And the reason why they did all this was because they wanted to kill a lot of people.
Attorney Michael Deutsch.
The state came in with an incredible amount of firepower. The prisoners were essentially unarmed, only had makeshift weapons. After they shot people down, people who were surrendering with their hands in their head, who were lying prone on the ground, were shot. People who were running away were shot in the back. They then proceeded to strip everybody and send them through lines of swinging guards with clubs.
They had officers lined up all on the hall, all everywhere. You know, you were scared to death because you were stripped naked. All you seen and heard was a lot of nasty words. They called you all kinds of niggas, you know. They called them the black niggas. They called them the white niggas. They called them the Puerto Rican niggas and so forth, you know.
And took the leaders who they believed were the leaders of the negotiations and put X's on their back.
When I was placed before the war, they put an X on my back. We theorized that this was intentionally done, man, to exterminate us. You know, the state troopers said that if we move, we were dead people, you know, dead men.
Literally tortured many of them and put them in cells nude, some with bullet wounds still in them. Many didn't get medical care. Many died from bleeding to death because they didn't get proper medical care, even though they knew prior to the time of the assault that they were going to come in that way. They only provided ambulances for the hostages. They had one ambulance for each hostage and no ambulances for the wounded prisoners.
They would line up on two sides as you would come down, and they would hit you with the sticks and the guns, you know, spit it at you. If you fall down, one of them would come and help you and start beating you with the back of the rifle butt. So once you got in the cell, they take you to the cell. They give you a beat and throw you back in the cell. They wouldn't feed you. When they did eat you, they put their hands in the food, put them in the food, stuff like that, you know. They'd come down and wake you up every few minutes for harassment, shake on the bars, get up, you know. Won't let you sleep. This went on for days. Left the windows open. No clothes. No shoes.
The mass murder that took place on the 13th of September. Cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Attica brother, Frank Big Black Smith.
I am telling you what I seen with my own eyes. I speak of my dead brother, L.D. Barkley. I know for a fact that he was premeditatedly murdered. I know this.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such.
I was almost taken out of the yard, and I was put on a table, nude. My body, at present, have cigar burns, cigarette burns all over it. My testicles at times bother me now from cigarette butts, sticks, rifles, laying on the table with my head looking up at the catwalk being spit on, hot shells thrown on my body. I tried to cover up with my pillow. Can you imagine 250 pounds getting under a pillow? State troopers and police came by and said, "Nigga, get out from under that pillow. We wanted you to have a cover. We would give you one. You gonna die in the morning, nigga, so it don't make no difference nowhere whether you freeze or we kill you. Nigga, black power, huh? Black power, huh? That's all was said to me while I was in that room. Trying to make me be the animal that he is. To reverse the victim to the criminal to the victim."
What happened after Attica, which was that you have this horrendous event where 43 people were killed, where 150 were shot, and where 1,289 were tortured. And the state then spent the next 30 years trying to cover it up. The story of that, of course, is unbelievable. They took bulldozers and they bulldozed the evidence in the yard.
which is all the casings and the shotguns and all of the evidence of their murders. They never noted who got one gun. They didn't follow any of the procedures which you're supposed to when you're about to use deadly force, right? Because they didn't want to. All they wanted was for these people to be blown away. And that's what happened. They got blown away.
So the first thing that had to be done was to defend the prisoners. There were 60 prisoners charged with over 1,400 felony counts. So lawyers came from all across the country to set up Attica Brothers legal defense and essentially put on a coordinated defense to stop the criminal charges. There was a big political movement that worked with the lawyers who said jail the real criminals, indict Rockefeller, and drop all the charges.
They spent $158 million prosecuting 62 inmates on 42 indictments, the largest of indictments in the history of the United States. And then that took place from 1971 until 1976.
And after many years of struggle, we were able to get all the charges dropped, but a few, and there were clemency given to the few that were convicted.
So after we fought the indictments, then we decided we needed to file a civil suit. And in 1974, we filed a civil suit asking the state of New York to pay us money for the shooting, the murders, and the torture.
And it took us essentially 20 years just to begin to tell those stories in court. There was just a tremendous amount of delays caused by the state. The state hired private lawyers who were paid millions of dollars. And after 20 years, we were able to get a case to trial in 91 and 92. And after a five-month trial in which many of the brothers testified, in which National Guard who came in to help with the medical care testified, doctors testified, even one or two state police testified, and some correctional guards testified, a jury of people from Buffalo all agreed that the assault itself inflicted cruel and unusual punishment, as well as the reprisals after the assault.
So we were in a catch-22, because the real issue was always whether what happened to them, which was so horrendous, transcended who they were, a bunch of rebellious third world convicts. And in front of regular people, just like us in Buffalo, racist, bad, the answer was yes.
That became a big thing. If a jury in Buffalo can have that kind of education and knowledge about who was wrong, who was right, because the people in the community really, really, really upheld the law.
And so the case went up on appeal, and in what is easily one of the most dishonest decisions that had ever been written, the Court of Appeal reversed all of our verdicts. What we had was a class action, and so we were able to file one suit for everybody who was in DUI at the time the shooting started. What the appellate court said was that it was not an appropriate case for a class action, and that we would have to do each case individually. So what that meant is we would have to do 1,286 cases rather than one. And after 26 years, 29 or however many years ago, we just did not have the ability to do that, right? And so therefore, they forced us to take $12 million, right? Which was an inadequate settlement, but the largest settlement in the history of the American prison movement, but still not justice by any means.
Three juries then found, after hearing the evidence, that there were violations of human rights and constitutional rights. But it was the judicial system, the courts, the men who decide the law, which prevented us from getting justice, essentially. It was not the people who heard the evidence.
As long as you take a man, a person, a woman, and treat them as a beast, you're going to always have a problem in these concentration camps. Because what is happening in these institutions is the most cruel and inhuman punishment and treatment that any person can be exposed to.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such.
People must know that we are dying. We are being murdered every day That is what's happening in here, in all the Atticus over the world.
The powers that be knew exactly what they were doing. They knew what weapons they were using. They knew what police force were they doing. They wanted that scorching. They could have taken over that yard without a shot, but they didn't want that. They wanted all that carnage, so everybody will see what happens when you rebel.
What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed.
Oppressed people without power can make a difference. They were able to get the eyes of the world to look at the prison system and to look at Attica. They sacrificed, in many cases, their lives to do it, but you never give up, and you continue to fight, and you continue to try and expose this injustice and make sure that human rights violators can never rest easy.
What I see is this for the people in the street. I see, wake up. Stop hiding. Because the same thing is happening to me is happening to you. And deal. Petition. Rallies. Let the people, let the governor, let the president and the people that's in a position to do something about this know how you feel about your sons and your daughters that's incarcerated. Other than that, wake up. Because nothing comes to a sleeper but a dream.
You've been listening to a special program from the Freedom Archives on the 30th anniversary of the Attica Prison Rebellion. Special thanks to Frank Big Black Smith and Attica attorneys Elizabeth Fink and Michael Deutsch. The program was produced by Lincoln Bergman, Anita DeJohnson, Andrea Lessler, and Clark. A contribution from the Robeson Foundation made this program possible. You can contact the Freedom Archives at 415-863-9977 or on the web at freedomarchives.org. This is Rhonda Romero. Thanks for listening.
TD Bank invites you to feed to Black Closing Fund, the Black Panthers' vanguard of the revolution, on Saturday, February the 27th at 7 p.m. at the D.B. Clark Theater, followed by a discussion with the famed director Stanley Nelson. The Black Panthers, a vanguard of the revolution, official selection of the Sundance Film Festival and the Montreal Black Film Festival. Get your tickets now on fadetoblack.ca for only $15. A Fabien Colas Foundation event.
That was a documentary about Attica Prison and the origins of the modern anti-prison movement. The time is presently 11:32, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. The documentary you just heard was made by folks at the Freedom Archives. You can check out all the wonderful audio from the project online at freedomarchives.org. Up next, we have audio from the Talk to Me project. Talk to Me is an ongoing audio project that addresses the silence around the prison system, specifically in regard to its Black population. It arises from knowledge in the Black community that Black people have long been subject to disproportionate imprisonment, and is bolstered by recent reports from the Federal Office of the Correctional Investigator. Talk to Me includes edited audio interviews with Black people who are formerly or currently imprisoned. It is both oral history and storytelling, as it focuses on the words of people with lived experience and aims to do a creative and just documentation of a reality that is violently silenced and denied.
Do you remember when we fell in love? We were young. Something. Do you remember how it all began?
Once in a previous conversation, you were talking about knee issues. I don't know if you were saying that you had some, or if ever somebody would have some in prison, it would take so long to be taken care of.
Oh, perfect example of that. Like my visits, you know, I've been trying to get my girlfriend on a visit.
Mm-hmm.
Been here for 2 years, I still haven't got her on a visit.
How come?
They tell me I have to talk to the sergeant who's in charge of the visits. I write a million memos to this guy. I even write memos to see this guy. I write complaint forms on the man, everything, and
mm-hmm.
I still can't get things fixed. Today I have an opportunity to go downstairs because we have the gym, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all my papers, all my complaint forms, everything, and I'm going to bring it down to another sergeant who has nothing to do with the visits and show them what's been going on with the other guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The only... I don't know how else to deal with this, so...
And was it a language issue? Like, the paperwork is in French, or is it in English? How does that go?
When I write English, sometimes I don't even get a response back. No, like, thank God I know how to write in French and stuff, so there's times I write it in French.
Mm-hmm.
And those that get responses back the next day, you know?
Interesting. I
always get responses back the next day when I write in English and French.
Hmm.
Come on, I didn't think you're a Frenchman.
Which might be a good thing for, well, helping you out.
It's a good thing and it's a bad thing, because it could be a good thing to help me out, yeah, but then it becomes a bad thing for the next person that is English, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? Because they get so used to, okay, people can write in French, so that person who's English should learn how to write in French, but hey, we're in Montreal, you're bilingual. First of all, you're supposed to be bilingual to even get a job in Montreal. You know what I mean? And here they want to try to force French upon you, so. Big language barrier problem over here, you know.
So there's no Anglophone guards?
There's a few.
Yeah.
Few, but then you have the ones who are French that do know how to talk English, because I pull them out sometimes, you know.
Mm.
And they would totally pretend like they don't talk English to, like, say, a new prisoner inmate that comes in, he's English. It totally, totally, totally bypasses English and just say, hey, je comprends pas le, pas mal français, s'il vous plaît, je comprends rien, qu'est-ce que tu dis? I'm just like, yo, I go and I talk to the guard, I'm like, yo, I've been here for 2 years, I've heard you talk English how many times? Don't try that shit because the guy's new, you know what I mean? Like, talk to the man. You understand what he's saying. Help the man out. That's what you're there for. You know? If you can't do it, then find somebody else that can. Even that, they don't do. You know? Like, there's a code that they're supposed to... The guards here in the bubble can't deal with something. We're supposed to be able to talk to a sergeant. You know? Like, go to the higher level. They don't even want to do that for us. You know? They refuse to call a sergeant for us.
So what's kind of like the typical response you receive when you ask for to put your girlfriend on the visit list, or to have any type of issue that you are facing and you need to speak to the guards, or you need to talk to the administration for whatever reason? What are the typical answers you get back?
I get back, honestly, they're like really like belittling me, basically, you know, like
mm-hmm.
Oh, we checked your file, you were supposed to mention this at administration, but at administration they don't do their job either, you know, so you want me to tell you something at administration? I've been in the building for 2 years, I don't leave the building. What administration am I ever going to go to? No.
Huh.
It may be an obvious question, but what would be your recommendation to fix or to transform this issue that you're experiencing?
Yeah, like with the administration problem, I've even wrote memos to say, like, I've been here for this long, I'd like to update my file, you know, like, suppose emergency numbers change, you know, girlfriends change, you know, even for outside girlfriends change on a regular, you know, we're in 2015 today, you know what I mean? Find a solid, firm couple, it's kind of hard, so couples change, people change, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How come we're not able to, if we find a new partner in life, how come we can't make a change, you know what I mean? Update our file, change who's there, what's up with all that, you know? It's honestly, some people just give up. I ain't giving up, though. The whole system needs to get checked, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of biases, you know, a lot of favoritism towards a color. There's a lot of language problems, you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot, really. If you can go down through the rules and regulations of the jail,
mm-hmm.
prefer the guards follow the rules and regulations to the T.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever we have to deal with, then to not follow anything at all and still give us a bunch of problems. Doesn't make any sense at all. Why have rules and regulations? You know?
That's true. Can you give us some examples of those rules that don't make sense?
Just did.
Man. You can pop with something in your head, honestly. Like, there's so much.
Yeah, I know, and you told us some. But, like, we're thinking if ever there's something we can do from the outside and spread out the word, sometimes they will ask us to be specific.
Well, even just the updating of the files, you know what I mean?
That would be very helpful.
For many people, because everybody's going through the exact same problem, you know? And then they're talking about, like, the guy's name was in charge of the visit. Nobody's ever seen this guy. Like, who is this guy? Is he a ghost? How come I've been here for 2 years and I've never seen him? I've seen every new sergeant, every old sergeant, every guard. I've seen all of them. You know? I've seen sergeants that don't even work on our side. They work on the other side of the jail. I've seen them. How come I can't see this guy?
That's interesting. What would be your theory on that?
He's a ghost.
That has power, though.
He doesn't exist.
So,
like, it's just a name that they're using.
That's
some more people, you know. Honestly.
So what I'm hearing is that one of your recommendations is that we have to use them account. We have to hold them accountable, and to respecting the policies and rules that they put in place.
Yeah, they really do have to respect these things, you know.
It would make life better.
Just updating people's files every, like, say, I'm not saying update every 2 weeks, say, like, at least every 6 months, check to see what's going on with people in the jail, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody doesn't want to do it on their own will, okay, you don't have to go check up on everybody. But if somebody writes a memo to you saying, look, I would like to update my file, well, mm-hmm. look into that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason he's saying that, you know what I mean? It's not for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
Things going on with his life outside that needs to get fixed, and you guys here need to know what's going on. Well, let's fix that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Supposed to be a rehabilitation and transition back into society. Well, let's do that.
Hmm.
You know?
So they really have to show sincere efforts about rehabilitating people as well.
Yeah. I don't know what what the formation is for a guard and what they have to do as a guard or a sergeant, but I know it's not just sitting behind a damn glass and playing on a computer all day. I know it's not that. I don't think any job in the world is that. Even a job that a secretary is not just that. She got to get up. She has to bring papers and sign papers or whatever it is. Everybody has something to do proper in their job.
Mm-hmm. And what you're saying that their jobs are?
Their jobs are what they do is basically just sitting down and behind the glass.
Mm. Called guard.
I don't think the government's really paying you just to sit behind the glass.
Can I ask you a question? It's a little, probably a much more personal sort of question around, you know, when I hear that you're inside and everyone is inside, I really have my sense is that there's a serious, you feel serious exclusion, you know, totally excluded.
Yeah.
Can you? Can you talk a little bit about feeling excluded and what would be some of those times or moments where you're feeling excluded?
My exclusion where I feel it comes from is just how long did I have to sit here to deal with a case. I feel like, okay, yeah, you know what? I'm really trying to keep me out of society. For what reasons, I have no idea. That's where I personally feel excluded. Do I feel excluded here from what's going on in the jail and all these kind of things? Not really, but for other people, they would like to go to school. They would like to have programs. They would, you know, they would like to be able to get out of the wing a little bit more and do something productive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like me personally, I just want to be able to get through my whole court problems. I'm not here to sit in jail and stay in jail. I'm trying to get out of here, trying to get this stuff dealt with, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's my whole thing here.
I'm not sure if I know your trajectory exactly, but is it the first time you went in prison, or you've been already?
No, I've been to jail before.
Okay, so when the last time or whatever time you went out, how was the transition?
Honestly, I have a lot of people behind me to help me out, so my transition is easy, you know?
Okay.
For the average person out there that doesn't have anybody, that doesn't know where to even look, there's nothing here to even show them the direction. Like, there's not even a person to point a finger, much less give them a paper or a pamphlet or something to show them, okay, look, this is where you can go, this is what you can do. Some people don't even know that they can get out of jail, go straight to the welfare office, and you'll get a check right away because you've been in jail. There's a lot of people that don't know that. Then they get out of jail, they're looking for jobs, can't find jobs, go right back into their crime. Because there's no money. How am I going to pay rent? Like, my boy just finished doing 3.5 years. Has nothing, has nobody, so he ends up having to sleep at my other boy's house. You know what I mean? And instead, somebody could have showed him, yo, you can go to the welfare office and get a check, and you can go to this area, which has the rent levels are to this and this, and you know what I mean? Get somewhere to stay.
Is there like a transition phase? Like, say you're going to be going out, you know, in the next 3 months, do they begin with this process of, okay, where are you going to stay? Where are you going to be? Or
there is nothing like that. There's nothing. Even when you do get sentenced, somebody comes to see you when you get sentenced. Oh, okay, yeah, these are what your charges are. What did you do outside? Like, it's what did you do? It's how are you doing things, not what are you going to do. Do you need help? You know what I mean? It's no questions like that. So everything is about the past. Well, the past is past.
Exactly.
You know, like, what we did in our past is what got us here in jail. So How can you help me to figure out how not to come back to jail?
So there needs to be like a much more forward thinking approach to it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, there really does, you know? Like, they have those violence programs and all those programs from the people at the YMCA there on Stanley, right? That YMCA, I've been there myself because I've had probation and whatever, whatnot. They have a structure there at the YMCA which does help you integrate into society once you're outside and you do know about it.
Okay.
Why doesn't that YMCA, since they do have programs in the jails, those things are ready from inside the jails? You know what I mean?
Begin the work before you come out.
Exactly, not just when you're outside or, you know.
So they need to provide rehabilitation programs and services inside.
Yeah, that would give tools for people to know where to go once they're outside, since the relationship is started from inside. And they're not lost. Okay.
You talked about not feeling that excluded in there, but so what about the feeling of being excluded from outside?
As in, can you explain that a bit more?
So you said, you know, well, I don't really feel that excluded in here because I have a mission and I just want to get out, but I feel very much excluded from the outside world.
Yeah, I feel like they're trying to keep me in here. That's what I was explaining before.
Okay.
Like, once I'm outside, there is no exclusion for me from anything. Anything I want to get involved in, I can, you know?
Okay. Yeah. I was just trying to get at sort of how do you handle feeling excluded from the outside?
How do I handle that? It's really rough. I've been sitting here 2 years trying to deal with a case that's not even a murder trial. It's not a murder my case at all. Why am I still here 2 years later trying to deal with something that they don't even have evidence for? That doesn't make any sense at all. I'm sitting here. Instead of giving me a day closer, you guys want to push my dates back 6 months, 8 months. Like, what is all that for? It's only when you really have somebody in jail, a member of a family or a boyfriend or a girlfriend or somebody, you know that's in jail and you hear about what's going on in jail, that's when you're like, oh. Like, I couldn't believe that's what's going on in jail. The way that the government portrays what's going on in here, you know? Back in the spring, every morning, birds sing. Do you remember? One of the most important topics is education.
Okay.
And, there's something I was talking about yesterday where they already, once you come through the system, based on where you're living, your location, they already basically just put you in certain sections. And, you know, they have regular blocks and they have the what they call the gang blocks.
Okay.
So they already put labels on certain young men, where these young men, the purpose should be when they're incarcerated to try to take those labels off of them and show them that they're all more than a label, or gang members, or gangdawoo, what they call it.
Yeah.
They choose to keep that division going by placing them in certain blocks, battles. Like, this one is the gang from Saint-Michel. This one is the gang from Pinerve. They don't mix. Instead of trying to find a common ground or people to come and basically have, let's say, meetings with these guys so they could cease the division going amongst them and killing one another, they'd rather just place them in different blocks where they could still see each other through the glass and go crazy and act like
you know, like maniacs.
Hmm.
You know, and one of the major things, if you go back to education, mm-hmm. is that those blocks, they specifically do not offer any type of education programs.
In the gang blocks?
In the gang blocks.
Okay.
But they offer those programs to the other blocks.
Oh, really?
Yes. So
wow.
When you come to a gang block, you are basically excluded and secluded from everything. Only time you go somewhere is if you go to the gym.
Okay.
Go to a visit. There's no education. There's no programs like to rehabilitate.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing offered to these blocks. And then when somebody asks for example, to go to school,
mm-hmm.
they send them a paper back charging them for everything, like $180 for the books. It'll be a 6-month program, and so on, but charging, as opposed to using the jail funds to fund the program to educate these young men. So it's like they're keeping them suppressed on the same level of education, where when they get back into society, they go right back to the gangbanging.
Of course.
Because they didn't learn nothing while they were sitting here for a year, 2 years, 6 months, whatever amount of time they're sitting here, mm-hmm. they have no type of communication with nobody. So it's not helping them to develop their line of communication, because they're not meeting with no counselors. They're not meeting with no teachers to teach them a proper way to present themselves for jobs, or the proper way to speak in society so to be accepted.
Hmm.
They no programs at all. Nothing. Nothing is offered to the gang. And only thing they could do is they could take courses, mm-hmm. but they will send them the books. So there's no interaction.
Okay, long distance.
Long distance, exactly. Long distance education, which mm-hmm. they have to pay for.
And there's no way.
Most of them don't have.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
Where in the other blocks, those other guys,
mm-hmm.
they're probably more privileged, and they probably could pay for their courses.
Hmm. And there's no way to get out of that label. Once you're in, you're put in that label, there's no way to change it.
There's no way to change it. They put that label on you, the police out there mm-hmm. put that label on you. When you first come in this jail, they put that label on you, that label stays on you.
And of course, I remember from our previous conversation, the label doesn't need to have a lot of proof to exist.
Not at all.
Exactly.
Okay. Like right now, I'm in the gang range.
Exactly.
I'm not a gang member.
Exactly.
I've never been affiliated with gangs.
Voila.
So, but you claim to put me in a gang range because of high security level.
Mm-hmm.
But when I go to court, I am with everybody else in the ballpark. I'm not secluded. You don't put me in a because when you high security,
mm-hmm.
they actually go with some extra measures to secure you. So, like when you go to court, they'll put you in a case by yourself. When you go to court, you won't be with the population. When you go to visit, they'll put you in a special booth. You can't be with the population. But that's not my case. I'm with everybody when I go to court. When I go to visit, I'm with the population.
Hmm.
So why is that I'm high security? Why? What tells you that I'm high security?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what justifies the need?
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
of being high security. And why these young men that needs the program the most, that money's not being spent on them? Why is it being spent on the Caucasians that's in the other blocks?
Because, of course, the underlying text from whatever you just said, when we put